It's time to kick back and grab a beer, because the space cadets are here. Talking about space and the universe, let's all be giant science nerds. We're the space cadets, yeah, we're the space cadets.
Welcome back to episode 7. Today we are joined by Alex. Alex, what's up, my friend? How we doing?
Hey, Toddy, what's up?
Not too much, man. Listen, I am excited about today because we are talking about the losers of the universe. And when I say losers, I'm talking about meteors. I'm talking about asteroids. And you might say to yourself, well, why are they losers? Do you have any idea why I might think that those celestial bodies are the losers of our universe?
So if I had to guess, it's because those are the ones that tried to be planets and failed. They failed to become planets.
That's exactly right, man. They gave it all they got, and what they got was not enough. That's exactly where I was going with that. That's our failed planets of the universe. So, you know, the smaller celestial bodies, some of which make their way all the way to Earth. And we're in this episode, we're going to go pretty deep into the effects of that and what we're doing to prevent it. But quick pop quiz for you, Alex. Okay. Two questions, actually. What does the word asteroid mean?
Oid, is that like object?
Close.
What? Okay. I don't know what the first part means.
So a Mr. William Herschel, ironically the same guy who discovered Uranus, not yours, but the one up there in space, was also the guy who discovered asteroids, and asteroid means star-like. So he knew they weren't stars because he was a pretty good astronomer. He knew they looked sort of like stars. And, you know, ironically, when some hit the Earth and those things fall through our atmosphere, they sometimes become shooting stars. And so the second part to this little pop quiz, to put you on the spot one more time, is every day, how many tons of material do you think, organic natural material like asteroids, come into Earth and actually leave debris?
Yeah, I think I do know the estimate of this. Is it about 100 tons?
You got it, man. 80 to 100 tons of material fall upon the Earth from space in the form of dust.
That's really crazy.
Right? And you'd think that more people would get clobbered by these things. You know, I was reading a story earlier today about a woman in Russia who a meteorite came straight through a roof, knocked off of a table or a counter in her bedroom and hit her in the bed and really messed her up, gave her a large bruise. Luckily, she was okay. But, you know, luckily our atmosphere does a good job of protecting us from most of these things.
Yeah, I think there was a woman in Alabama as well in the 1950s who was injured by an asteroid or a meteorite, I should say, because it hit the Earth.
Here's something pretty interesting, right? Already in this conversation, we've probably misused the terms asteroid, meteoroid, meteors, meteorites, comets, all these different celestial things that are floating around our solar system and our universe, some of which come into our atmosphere and burn up. Maybe you can help us clarify some of the differences between those different types of rocks.
Yeah, Todd. So I think, at least for asteroids, those are objects in space, which are failed planets are orbiting the sun, but are small in size. Whereas comets also orbit the sun, but are icy in origin and have long tails and revolve around the sun in elliptical orbits. And then when you're talking about a meteor, that's what's kind of going through the atmosphere. That's like a shooting star that you see. And a meteorite would be an object that's landed on the Earth. Something that you'd find after it hit, hopefully not too hard or else you wouldn't be around to find it, but an object that has survived the atmosphere and made it onto the planet. How'd I do?
You did great, man. That's exactly right. All of the different things that you mentioned there. The one thing that I didn't know in starting this research, or maybe I knew but didn't have a deep understanding in, is the difference between asteroids and comets. And like you said, an asteroid is just a large rocky body out in space, orbiting the sun, right? And just sort of this elliptical orbit just floating around. They are failed planets, and most of them are found between Mars and Jupiter in the asteroid belt. That's where a lot of that space junk sort of started, coalesced, if you will. in the formation of our galaxy and our solar system. They have no atmosphere, but ironically, some of them actually have moons because they're big enough, even though they don't have their own atmosphere, they're not planets, that they can have enough gravitational pull to start pulling some other asteroids to circle them and sort of have their own quasi-moons, if you will. And a comet is, instead of being made of iron and rock, which is what most of those asteroids are, is instead made of ice and water and gases, right? And so that's why they have those long tails, because most of the time when we see one of those, what we're seeing is all that ice burning off, either as a result of coming too close to a planet's atmosphere or impacted by the sun's heat that's actually melting that as it goes into direct sunlight. So those are the main differences. And you know, one of the major comets that I know people are probably most familiar with is the Shoemaker-Levy comet, which fell into Jupiter and exploded back in 1994. What I thought was crazy is everybody's probably familiar when you look at a picture of Jupiter, you see that giant red spot, which is shrinking, and it's basically a humongous hurricane about double the size of our Earth. But when the Shoemaker-Levy comet hit into Jupiter, it left a scar for months that was not bigger, but more pronounced in terms of visible light than even the Great Red Spot. And so I thought that was super interesting.
Wow. Yeah, I find asteroids and meteors so interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, especially with the impacts, it could happen at any time. We don't, of course, the larger ones we can now detect, but the smaller ones, we have really no idea when they're going to hit, what angle they're going to hit, where they're going to hit. The Chelyabinsk event, which I think we'll discuss in a little bit, in Russia in 2013, you know, no one had any idea that was coming, and it exploded with the force of an atomic bomb above Russia, and that just kind of blows my mind. And the other thing about asteroids and meteors is, you know, is this something that the world's going to come together about, that we're serious about possibly deflecting a meteor if we find it that's going to be threatening? What's people's reaction going to be if they find out that this is going to happen? Is society going to break down? Or are we going to work together to try to solve it? I just think it's an interesting cultural question.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look to Hollywood, we're going to send a bunch of drillers up there and hopefully try and save the world. But we'll get to Armageddon in a little bit. But you mentioned the Chelyabinsk meteor. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. In 2013, so let's talk about that a little bit. It was the largest impact in the last century. It happened over Russia. The meteor itself wasn't all that large. It was about 66 feet long. And it hit the Earth's atmosphere at just under 43,000 miles an hour. And one of the things you mentioned before, Alex, was that sort of low angle of approach that's possible, or more specifically, the fact that meteors can come from anywhere. And there's no trajectory that can sort of be pre-plotted or planned in a lot of these cases, especially back, you know, in the time when this happened in 2013, before we really perceived this as being like a huge risk. And so because of the low angle of approach of this particular meteor, it exploded about three times higher than commercial airplanes fly. So about 97,000 feet up in the air, and caused a bunch of smaller pieces to break off. So it's actually really cool. If you go on YouTube, you can Google footage of this, and people from dashboard cameras and from surveillance cameras, you can actually see these smaller pieces of debris flying across this area. But it caused damage to over 7,000 buildings. It sent 1,500 people to the hospital for some severe injuries. There was no deaths, thankfully, but it was 30 times as powerful as the bomb that hit Hiroshima. So when you think about the level of power that comes from something natural like this, and just the impact of that rock, that iron hitting an air, the air of our atmosphere, gave it so much power to explode with that much ferocity. It's absolutely incredible. And so we're going to talk in a little bit about what we're doing as a society, to your point, to prevent these things in the future, or at least hopefully learn about them early enough to take preventative measures. But one of the things that I also wanted to talk about today was an impact that happened quite a bit before the Chelyabinsk incident that we just talked about. This one takes place a little bit closer to the U.S., right around the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and was discovered in 1978 during a magnetic survey for an oil company. And Alex, I think you know where I'm going with this. It's what caused the demise of everybody's favorite reptilian or avian, however you want to look at it, friends. You want to tell us a little bit about what killed the dinosaurs?
Well, you know, it's a good question, Todd. And for a long time, I think scientists were kind of puzzled by this. They couldn't quite figure it out. They thought maybe it was volcanoes. They thought maybe there was climate change. But what it appears to be is that a object, asteroid, became a meteor up to 50 miles wide. A huge object hit the Earth right around where the Yucatan Peninsula is now, and wiped out upwards of 50% of life on Earth at that time. Really, when you think about it, it must have gouged out such a huge part of the surface that it caused what's similar to a nuclear winter, and most dinosaurs and other organisms around at that time couldn't survive. However, what did survive is our predecessors, right? The mammals, which would someday become us.
I wonder why that is, right? You know, one of the other things that I know we wanted to talk about today was, you know, when you look at the moon and you see all these scars, and then you look at the Earth, far less scars, but also far more things to cover it up. Do you think that whether it's water or it's, you know, our jungles and, you know, our climates and things like that, I would have to assume that largely impacted the ability for, you know, these anything that really wasn't a dinosaur that was sort of landlocked and stuck sort of where they were, things that had the ability to move and migrate and go to these areas that were a bit safer probably fared quite a bit better, would you say?
Yeah, and I think that the mammal predecessor of us that was around back then was a burrowing animal, kind of like a rat or a weasel, and it was able to burrow underground and protect itself from the havoc that was going on in the atmosphere at that time.
What about, you know, we've heard of Pangaea, and we've heard of all these different continental positions that have been affected by the tectonic movements of the Earth. And, you know, for our listeners, the tectonic movements are simply that the crust of the Earth is really just a bunch of different plates sort of floating on top of the mantle, right? All this liquid and semi-liquid lava or magma for lack of a better term. And they're slowly shifting, and that's what causes earthquakes. And it also causes dynamic changes in the environment around us and in the way our landscape looks. And so, Alex, what do you think about the way that affects the presence of the history of the impacts that maybe have been on this planet?
Yeah, right. I think that's well said, Todd. Obviously, when you look at the moon and you look at the Earth, right, they look completely different. And that's mostly because the moon doesn't have tectonic plates, so you can see all the impacts that have pretty much ever hit the moon. They're all still there. Whereas for us, everything gets slowly recycled because of rain and because of erosion things. Craters can get less prominent over time. And obviously, if something hits the ocean, then you might not see, even though it might have worldwide effects, huge tidal waves, things like that. You might not see the actual crater itself. So
pretty fair to say that the moon is hashtag no filter, and we're using like all of the Instagram filters possible on Earth here to make ourselves look good.
Nice. I like it.
Let's talk a little bit about something that was recently in the news that I thought was interesting, and I'm going to butcher this name, but we recently had our first identified interstellar object, meaning that it originated outside of the solar system, fly through the solar system, not super close to Earth, about 85 times the distance from Earth to moon, and the distance from the Earth to the moon. It's about a 250,000 miles, so you guys can do that math if you're listening. This thing was about 3,000 feet long, 500 feet skinny, I should say, because that's a, you know, very, very long, thin, football-shaped object.
Yeah, it was like shaped like a cigar, right?
That's right. That's right. And luckily for us, nobody on Earth got a chance to smoke it, because that thing would have smoked us, I think.
Yeah.
But it was called Au Mau Mau. And it was the first sort of interstellar traveler. And there was a lot of conspiracy theorists out there saying that it was an alien spaceship sent to spy on us. But by the time that it got close enough to Earth for us to see, we could see clearly that it was simply just a rock that got thrown off of some path from somewhere, likely billions and billions of years ago. And it was not rotating, you know. So if you think about sort of a javelin spear being thrown and rotating in a nice tight spiral, it wasn't really doing that, right? It was sort of tumbling end over end, moving way too fast for it to be captured by gravity in any capacity. And so it'll likely never be seen again, but it was our first visitor from outside the solar system. And I know scientists were super pumped to get to see that.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the cool thing about it was most of the objects that we see are from the solar system, or at least maybe from right outside the solar system where the comets like to hang out. But they think Umama or Umema, or however you said it, was truly interstellar, like it came from somewhere totally different and passed through the universe on its way to nothingness, I guess. Yeah, and so Au Mau Mau, which brought a lot of people's attention to these NEOs, near-Earth objects, made us think what other objects are out there. Obviously, we know that the Chelyabinsk event, which, again, was in 2013 in Russia, was a maybe 65-foot-wide object that we didn't have any idea about, which impacted the atmosphere, caused 1,500 injuries, and was seen by millions of people across the globe. It made people think, what can we do to stop this? What other options do we have out there?
Yeah, and ironically, the Chelyabinsk incident really started to bring to a head the need to address this. And so in our own U.S. House of Representatives, the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, right after that event, held a hearing to discuss asteroid threats to Earth. And I think before that moment in 2013, nobody really focused on this, right? It was a thing of sci-fi movies like Deep Impact and Armageddon, and it really didn't resonate in anything that was factual or really needed to be cared about from the scientific and government communities. But what happened was NASA established what they call the Planetary Defense Coordination Office, and they started to invest heavily in the ability to track different NEOs or near-Earth objects. And so they're at the point now where things can be, 450 feet across and thousands and thousands of miles away, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of miles away. And they can still track those and predict the path of orbit of those specific bodies. One of those orbiting bodies that is potentially hazardous. When I say potentially hazardous, I mean they have over a 99.9% certainty it's not going to hit Earth in the next century. But it's one of those things where it's coming within 5 million or so miles of Earth, and even though that seems like so far away in astronomical terms, that's a relatively small distance. And this is an asteroid called Bennu. And what's really cool about this is NASA's actually got a mission out there where we're orbiting this thing with a probe called the OSIRIS-REx, and it stands for Origin, Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification, Security, and Regolith Explorer. If you want to remember all that, I just call it the OSIRIS-REx. And this thing is, its job is to start to understand the makeup of these asteroids to try and figure out what we can do from a protective standpoint to help shield ourselves from the risks that these things pose, I'm sure, as well as understand how we can mine these things for money. But, moving from identifying these threats, right, we have a great tools in NASA and the ability to track these objects and see them. But let's just say there was like a locomotive train of an asteroid heading straight towards Earth. What could we do to stop it? There have been movies that have shot up some different ideas. Alex, do you think you have any good ideas as to what you would do to stop these things?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different theories, right? And obviously, like you said, if you've seen the movies, you send up an oil rigging crew to blow it apart from the inside. Now, the issue with that, if you're speaking about Armageddon, as I'm referencing, is maybe you create multiple projectiles instead of just one that are going to take out various different parts of the Earth. So people think that's not the best idea.
What's interesting about that is not all asteroids are created equal, right? The whole point of being an asteroid is a failed attempt to become a perfectly spherical planet. So as a result, what you wind up with are these things that are jagged and different shapes and slightly different compositions and fractures and cracks. And who's to say that, and this is the biggest risk with that approach, A, we probably don't have the ability to do it. But let's say we drop a nuke down inside of an asteroid using a drilling crew and we're able to detonate it. We don't know how this thing is going to fracture because it's not going to be a straight line. And every single one of these asteroids is different. And that's one of those things that's almost impossible to plan for. So I think they nixed that one pretty quick, but certainly does make for good TV.
Yeah. The thing I still don't get about Armageddon is why do you send up an oil rigging crew when I'm sure they have plenty of good astronauts out there who could do a similar thing?
Well, Mark made this point in, I think it was our first or second episode, that they sent up a drilling crew along with astronauts, which does seem weird, although I guess the specialty of drilling into unique surfaces is something that only a drilling crew could do. But I think more importantly, why a Gatling gun? They brought a Gatling gun up to the asteroid.
Yeah, that just seems like a terrible idea.
So what about shooting this thing, right? So we can't go in and we can't blow it up from the inside, but why can't we just take like 50 nukes and just send them that way?
You risk breaking it apart asymmetrically into different projectiles that'll then hit different parts of the Earth. And so instead of one projectile that you can follow and know exactly where it's going to hit, you have 30, 40, 100 different parts that are going to hit different areas.
Yep. And some scientists had done the research and they found that it would take 10 million Hiroshima-sized bombs to destroy an incoming asteroid. These things are traveling 12 miles a second. I mean, they're made almost of pure iron, right? In most cases, iron and other types of heavy rock. And so, you know, for the large ones, it's not something that you're just going to be able to blast out of the sky. I think the reference in Armageddon they use is like shooting a BB at a speeding train. It's not going to do anything. But what we can do, and what scientists are focusing on, is influence the movement of them slightly. And when I say slightly, I mean by centimeters. So what scientists are looking to do is find ways. They have two different methodologies for this. One is to slowly bombard an asteroid with smaller explosions on one side of it to make it move centimeters off course, which also sounds sort of like just shooting it, but I guess the perpetual motion of that. Anything in space that creates an opposite direction, whether it's an explosion or pieces coming off of a body itself, almost act as thrust in the opposite direction. So the asteroid could potentially be pushed a certain way. But the caveat there is centimeters don't do anything when you're a million miles away from Earth. You're already too close. So if you can find an asteroid that's way farther out than that, and that is on a trajectory to impact Earth, then you have the opportunity at that point when it's, and I don't know the exact number, let's just assume millions of miles away, knocking it just slightly off course, even centimeters is enough to, over those long, long distances, make that thing move. And a good way to think about this for our listeners is if you take a laser pointer and you point it directly in front of you at a wall that's, you know, maybe 10 feet from you, and you move it from one side to the other of that wall. And now let's picture, you know, that took a second for you to do. Now let's think about a bigger surface. You go to, you know, you have a super strong laser pointer and you point that at the face of the moon and you can see that red dot. Now, instead of you having to move your hand probably 3 or 4 inches to move that laser pointer across the wall, just by twisting your wrist slightly because of the distance between you and the moon, that light's going from one side of the moon to the other. And the same concept applies when you think about the small changes in trajectory that can help direct these asteroids off course and hopefully not to impact us in the future.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Todd. I think that was a good example too. If you, you know, over long distances, just a little bit of movement can really change a lot.
And one of the final things that they're doing here is, instead of, you know, bombs, right, they have something called DART, which is the double asteroid redirection test, which is using high-powered lasers to blow small pieces off of these things as they're coming close to us. Thought process there is the same, right? If we can blow off a small chunk and have that shoot in a different direction, that opposite force is going to continually bombard the asteroid itself in a slightly different direction. So that, you know, that in and of itself hopefully will help protect us in the future, one of these methods, but it's all reliant on our investment in the technology to identify these things as quickly as possible. And in 2020, our capabilities are actually going to improve dramatically when we launch the large synoptic survey telescope in Chile, which is going to be dedicated to looking for as many of these objects as possible and helping us to predict their courses.
I think that that's a step in the right direction, because statistically, about once a year, an automobile-sized asteroid hits the Earth's atmosphere. Now, that will just create a fireball and burn up. But every 2,000 years, a meteoroid the size of a football field hits the Earth and causes significant damage to the surrounding area. And once every few million years, 1, 2, 5 million years, you know, again, statistically speaking, an object large enough to threaten Earth's civilization comes along. So, you know, something like this will happen again. It's going to happen. And it's just a matter of when. So preparing for it is really the only option we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want evidence, I think, Alex, you were telling me before we got on the episode here, there's places in the U.S. that you can go and actually see evidence of these impacts.
Right. If you want a really dramatic example, Meteor Crater in Arizona, I think it was about 50,000 years ago, a meteorite landed there. The crater is over, it's really well preserved. You can walk right around it. Can't walk into it, but you can walk around it. And it's over 500 feet deep. And you can see just how, you know, powerful and strong these collisions can be. And that was a very small object, too. Nothing compared to the other things that we were talking about.
Yeah. Wow. So switching to a little bit of a lighter topic, you know, as we start to wrap up here, what's your favorite asteroid or meteor or comet related movie that's out there?
So we talked about Armageddon a little bit, but I'm going to have to go with Deep Impact. Now, Todd, do you remember that both Deep Impact and Armageddon came out at almost exactly the same time in 1998?
I did not realize that. No.
Yeah, they came out within like months of each other, and they're almost the exact same movie. But I do like Deep Impact more. I think it's a bit more realistic, and obviously a huge Elijah Wood fan because of Lord of the Rings. So.
Now, Alex, in Deep Impact ended a lot differently than Armageddon ended, though, if I'm remembering correctly, right? It's been a while since I've seen that movie.
This is true. Yes.
Okay. And is this the one where the woman who's had the issue in her relationship with her father, it's been almost 20 years. So I don't mind giving away spoilers. So where she hugs her father on the beach as a tidal wave miles high destroys them.
You are absolutely correct. I think if our listeners haven't seen Deep Impact yet, you know, they should have. So that's fine.
that's one of the final things that I wanted to talk about. Like, people think about these explosions that are powerful, like atomic bombs, but you know, if you think about the risk factor, almost, I shouldn't say almost none, but a lower percentage of the risk is associated with the actual explosion, you know, minus being inside the area of where the crater is, and are more related to atmospheric pressure changes and heat. And actually, most commonly, given the fact that most of our planet's covered in water, the effects of gigantic tsunamis and tidal waves that could be the result of a deep impact.
Right. And To give an example, you know, about 30 million years ago, a meteorite landed in the what is now the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, near the border of Maryland. And they think, the scientists think, that that impact, which was a large object many miles across, caused tidal waves 1,500 feet tall. And again, that's just, it just boggles the mind to think about that and what kind of effects that would have on modern society. But yeah, these objects, they make impact craters, but then they also cause
shockwaves.
Yeah. So the shockwaves just emanate out and can be very strong, like you said, and there can be earth and ash and dust thrown up in the air that blocks out the sun, and that causes plants to die, and then it's just a huge cycle of death and badness. So another reason why asteroids and meteor impacts are just bad news and something we need to take care of.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Alex, we're going to wrap up the show. I appreciate you you joining, as always, today. I want to toss something out to our listeners. We are on Twitter. Our handle is @SpaceCadetsShow. And what we thought would be really cool idea would be to get some fan-submitted topics and ideas for future shows. And if you're lucky enough and we like your topic quite a bit, then who knows, maybe we'll even start inviting some of our Twitter followers and listeners onto the show as well to give their input into some of these topics. So we're looking at creative ways to get our audience as engaged as possible. So please interact with us, follow us. We put out some good content there on Twitter as well. Alex, again, thank you for the time today. And to our listeners, maybe the next time you look up in the sky and you see a shooting star, instead of making a wish, you'll say, man, am I thankful that that was just a small little meteorite and not something bigger that we didn't see coming. Have a good one, Space Cadets.